I want to know if the guards are trained to know if someone's real sick and if it's a policy of the prison to send in a medic who is 5 feet away from her cell.
An emotional hearing on inmate deaths. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a call for stable forward funding for the Indian Health Service.
When are you going to get the money, and what is your plan to pay back the amount borrowed with interest? The answer is generally, I don't know. It's up to Congress.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
A number of inmate deaths in Alaska prisons over the past few months has prompted state legislators to seek answers. But at a hearing hosted by Senator Hollis French today in Anchorage, few questions were resolved. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
In a hushed room, Constance Anderson held a photo of her daughter, Kristen Simon, aloft for all to see.
So I have a lot of questions. I want to know if the guards are trained know if someone's real sick and if it's a policy of the prison to send in a medic who is 5 feet away from her cell. There was a medic 5 feet away from her cell. 5 feet, from what I understand, is what I've been told. Do you know how painful that is? I love my daughter. She was an overcomer. She worked with people with disabilities and she had a disability herself.
Simon, age 33, was found dead in a holding cell in the Anchorage Correctional Center on June 6th of this year. Anderson relates Simon's medical history, her troubled past, her drug addiction, but she said she's not buying the explanation that Simon may have died from heart failure. Simon's death was the fourth of an inmate this year, but not the last. In a packed hearing room at Anchorage's temporary legislative information office, people sat on the floor, stood in the hallways, and listened to Vernicia Gordon, fiance of 20-year-old Devin Mosley, who died in an Anchorage jail in April of this year. Gordon read from a prepared statement tracing the timeline of Mosley's incarceration and sudden death. He died almost a week after his case had been dismissed.
6 days after dismissal, still no phone contact from Devon. I'm asked to visit and still told no. 4-4, 1 week after dismissal, still no phone call from Devon. Devon dies at 1:44 p.m. I go to the jail at 2:15 and I'm told to come back for a visit at 5:30.
In both cases, officials say no foul play is suspected, but family members who testified said the bodies were covered with bruises. Gordon had the photos to prove that. Senator French, along with fellow Democrats Senator Berta Gardner and Representatives Andy Josephson and Jaron Tarr, heard testimony from Department of Corrections Commissioner Joe Schmidt and from Brad Wilson, who heads the Alaska Corrections Officers Association. Schmidt and Wilson are at odds, specifically over the issue of staffing in Alaska's prisons, Commissioner Joe Schmidt.
1-5 is a ratio. It stacks up well nationally. If there was a certain number, we do staffing analysis, we analyze post orders, we look at the workload, we look at the schedule, the hours we have to cover, and we make decisions. No one has ever said what that magic number is. How many state employees do we have to hire to guarantee nobody's going to get hurt? There isn't one. When the prisoners came home from Colorado, our prisoner population went up 27.5%. Staffing went up 28% in that same time period. What's significant there is correctional officers went up 33%.
Commissioner Schmidt said about a dozen inmates in the state's prison system die every year, well below the national average. But Wilson says DOC's staffing numbers are off.
Yes, this is 5-1, but four shifts. Three of them aren't on. But using his math, that means it's 20-1. 20-1. 3/4 of them aren't even there. They're off.
Wilson says there needs to be an independent review of each of the deaths. Perhaps the most telling information to come out of the hearing dealt with the mental health of inmates on intake. DOC's Laura Brooks.
We have a new report out from the Mental Health Trust Authority that says about 65% of our population are mental health trust beneficiaries. About 22% of those are what we would call the severely and persistently mentally ill. So those, that 22% include those people with disorders like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia.
Jeff Jesse, director of Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, confirmed that 65% of inmates are mental health beneficiaries. Jesse told the panel that under the Murkowski administration, prison mental health programs were discontinued. But in recent years, the trust has worked with DOC on improving programs for inmates who are mental health beneficiaries. Wilson says corrections officers do not have the training to deal with mentally ill patients.
Unfortunately, the Alaska institutions are the largest mental health providers in the state of Alaska, and their main contact there is correction officers. We need more training for correction officers. They're not trained psychologists, but they're the ones that end up having to counsel these individuals, to work with these individuals.
Perhaps the most notorious prison death in Alaska happened last year when serial killer Israel Keyes took his own life while incarcerated. The corrections officer on duty at the time, Lauren Jacobson, was fired by the state, but ACOA has defended the guard and said the state made him a scapegoat. An arbiter has said the firing was not justified. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
More than 50 people gathered in the Government Hill neighborhood of Anchorage this afternoon to protest the demolition of two homes. The state is clearing the land to make way for the proposed but not yet funded Kinnick Arm Bridge. KSKA's Ann Hillman spoke with community members.
Stop the demolition now! Stop the demolition now!
Anchorage residents from across the city stood in front of a blue house waving signs reading, "Haste makes waste and save our homes." Ann Redding was among them.
This is my neighborhood. I live three houses this way. I don't want a big gaping hole waiting for something that's not funded. You know, they're taking away my neighborhood. They're ruining where I live.
Two houses and the old sourdough lodge are being demolished in preparation for the proposed $1.6 billion Kinnick Arm Bridge. So far, the state has only secured about $150 million for the project. The protesters say the state is moving too hastily. Why should the state remove homes when it's unclear if the project will actually happen? Most of the federal funding the state is trying to secure has historically gone toward projects in much larger, congested urban areas. 96-year-old Marjorie Ellis built her home in Government Hill in 1950. It's set to be demolished during another phase of the project.
We don't need terrorists when we have Kabata. Everything they've done is to destroy Government Hill, which is the oldest community in Anchorage.
Before the protesters gathered, Department of Transportation spokeswoman Jill Reese and the property manager led a tour of the buildings.
Probably want to just wait, like three people come up at a time, because these are not very sturdy.
The upstairs portion of the blue house was filled with sun from the skylights and soaring windows. The musty ground floor had ripped up carpet and asbestos ceiling tiles. DOT's Reese points out damage.
Practically everything in here, in the whole house, would need to be redone. And as you'll see, there's broken bathroom fixtures and those sorts of things. So
Reese says all three buildings are in the way of the bridge project. She explains the state moved quickly to purchase the buildings and relocate the tenants because that process can take a lot of time.
You can't wait until you're ready with the financing to start building the bridge. You might be 3 or 4 years down the line at that point of just getting properties purchased. Also, especially in the Anchorage Bowl, prices aren't going down.
Reese says the state will pay for the removal of the buildings, which could cost between $500,000 and $1 million. Then they'll be reimbursed if they get the federal grant. And the houses don't have to be destroyed. Reese says they can also be moved to other parts of town. That's what happened to some condos when Dowling Road was built.
If there's a dollar to be made on these properties in their whole form, I'm sure that's the route that will be taken. And if not, then they'll be demolished.
All of the contractors who were walking through the properties during the protest declined to comment. They were examining the project before submitting bids by the 25th. Some of the protesters say that it doesn't matter if they tear down or relocate the buildings. It still leaves a hole in the neighborhood. And Lance Powell from Mid Hillside says not only people in Government Hill should be concerned.
Well, if it can happen here, it can happen at any neighborhood in Anchorage.
Powell says empty lots deter business and new residents from coming into the area. Others say roads divide communities and cause deterioration, and that's not what they want.
What do we want?
Homes!
What do we need?
Homes!
What are we going to save?
Homes!
DOT has scheduled for the properties to be cleared by November and the areas to be planted over with grass. They do not have a set schedule for when the bridge would be funded or built. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
The CEO of Kotzebue-based Manilik Association today urged a U.S. House subcommittee to pass a bill that would provide advance funding for the Indian Health Service. Tim Shirk says the uncertainty and delays in federal funding makes it hard to run a hospital and hire healthcare professionals. He spoke in favor of legislation that would have Congress appropriate money a year in advance for the IHS, as it does now for the Veterans Health Administration.
If I don't know where the money is going to be coming from in October, November, December, how can I make those commitments to those health professionals to hire them? Our doctors have to know that they're going to get a paycheck.
One way or another, the bills must be paid. And if the federal funds aren't there, Shirk says he must pursue other options, like asking a bank for a line of credit or a bridge loan.
Inevitably, what's going to happen in that discussion is the bank is going to ask me, So what is your plan to pay the money back? When are you going to get the money? And what is your plan to pay back the amount borrowed with interest? And the answer is generally, I don't know. It's up to Congress.
Without concrete answers, Shirk says borrowing is difficult and advanced federal appropriations would help alleviate many of the current problems. The Manilik Association provides health services to 12 federally recognized tribes and 8,000 people in Northwest Alaska. In the U.S. Senate race, it appears Republican candidate Dan Sullivan is sustaining his fundraising momentum. He reports nearly $1.2 million in donations for the second quarter of the year. That makes three straight quarters for him, where contributions exceeded $1 million. Incumbent Senator Mark Begich reports raising only slightly more for the quarter. Sullivan's contributions come primarily from out of state, but his campaign says he raised almost $200,000 of his money in-state during the previous 3 months. Today is the federal deadline for campaign finance reports covering April through June. Republican challengers Joe Miller and Mead Treadwell have not yet announced their totals. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bethel residents voice their concern about a sunken barge.
It's going to be starting to get dark pretty soon, and nighttime you can't see that, you know, that there is a barge there. So I'm sure somebody's going to get hurt.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
The World Eskimo Indian Olympics start tomorrow in Fairbanks, with qualifiers for events like One-Armed Reach and the Race of the Torch ahead of opening ceremonies at 6 p.m. inside the Carlson Center. WEO started in 1961 as a way to bring athletes and dancers from across Alaska together for competitions and celebration. Since then, it has grown into a tournament-style athletic competition, as well as pageantry, showcasing skills like skin sewing and recognizing ongoing achievement in cultural practices. WEO has also served as an organizational body for establishing uniform standards for Native games from around diverse parts of the state. It is one of the reigning authorities in the world on records for events played across the circumpolar north, like one-foot high kick, knuckle hop, and ear pull games rooted in testing and strengthening abilities necessary for subsistence. While alcohol is usually a fixture of most political fundraisers, there will be no wine or cocktails at events focused on the marijuana initiative. The opposition group Big Marijuana, Big Mistake is hosting its first fundraiser tonight, and the only beverages available will be
delicious lemonade, sparkling waters,
all kinds of, fun pop and soda.
Deborah Williams is the former Democratic Party chair, and she's co-hosting the event alongside former governors Frank Murkowski and Bill Sheffield. Because the ballot initiative they're fighting would allow the sale of marijuana, organizers decided weeks ago that they should make the event substance-free.
Former State Representative Alice Hanlight recommended that we make this event alcohol-free, and we all enthusiastically agreed.
But the group didn't originally make that clear that their event was going to be dry. On Tuesday morning, sponsors of the initiative sent out a press release advising people who attend the fundraiser to exercise caution if offered alcohol, because research has concluded that it is more harmful than marijuana. The campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol also pointed out that Murkowski received nearly $20,000 in political contributions from the alcohol industry during his last decade in the U.S. Senate. Williams believes that was uncalled for and described implications of hypocrisy and the attack on Murkowski as nasty. But Chris Rempert, who is the political director for the pro-marijuana campaign, still believes the criticism of his opponents is merited, even if they're not serving hard drinks at their event.
Alcohol is frequently a major part of political events, and since their invitation was touting refreshments, and since the event is being hosted by an alcohol-friendly governor like Murkowski, we felt it was important to convey the message.
For their part, the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol does not plan on serving alcohol at any future events they host. A state report on the response to the 2013 flooding in Galena says more than 5,000 containers of hazardous materials scattered throughout the area during the disaster were collected. The containers ranged from aerosol cans to 55-gallon drums, with the hazardous debris strewn along a 15-mile radius of the Yukon River village. An environmental program specialist with the agency estimated the cleanup cost at well over $1 million, costs that will be included as the state seeks reimbursement from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Residents of fish camps along Steamboat Slough near Bethel are calling for an abandoned barge to be removed. The barge has been sitting half-submerged in the middle of the slough for more than a year. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
Barbara Anville is furious the barge has been left in the slough, which serves as a highway for boats in summer and for snow machines and four-wheelers in winter. She says the barge is right in the middle of that highway, and it's a safety hazard.
This winter, somebody got hurt with a four-wheeler. In fact, my brother's the one who came across his four-wheeler over there by the barge. There was lots of blood and stuff around it.
That blood was then 28-year-old Jason Fisher's. He says he was driving his four-wheeler around 10 o'clock on December 16th on his way home from Bethel to Quethluck when he hit the barge. He doesn't remember much because the impact knocked him out. He had a head injury and was in the hospital for about a month. He had to have surgery to amputate 9.5 of his fingers. Bethel police and search and rescue officials confirm Fisher's story. The barge named Shanks Ark sunk in 2012 or 2013. Officials with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources say the barge is owned by Bethel-based Kuskokwim Lighterage and Trucking and was being leased and operated by Faulkner Walsh Constructors, also of Bethel. Anna Hoffman is CEO of Bethel Native Corporation. She also has a family fish camp on the slough. She wrote to the Coast Guard, which she says identified the barge as a navigational hazard that requires no action on their part.
I was pretty alarmed at the fact that the barge really is left there, sunken in the middle of the slough. It seems to be a real hazard.
She called on Alaska senators for help. Senator Lisa Murkowski met with residents about the problem. Murkowski's office says they've been monitoring the situation and in touch with state officials about the barge. Still, nothing has been done. Harry Faulkner, an owner of Faulkner Walsh Constructors, says the State Department of Environmental Conservation and the DNR have their facts wrong. He says he was done leasing the Shanks Ark barge, which he was using to haul fish, by the time it was moored in Steamboat Slough.
We put it away for the year, and it decided to float itself out in the spring of the following year.
They said it happened while it was moored and you were still leasing it.
That is not correct. We had it leased for the year and we were done with it.
Okay, can you send me the documents that show the time period for which you were leasing it?
No.
Why not?
Because it was a verbal agreement between the fish manager and Dave Osdahl, the owner of the barge.
Dave Osdahl refutes Faulkner's claims and says Faulkner Walsh failed to secure the vessel when they put it away after fishing season.
I provided the barge to Faulkner Walsh for their fishery operations in exchange for them fetching and returning to storage each year and keeping it floating. So it was under their care, custody, and control through the 2012 season when they were to put it away properly.
But they didn't put it away properly, claims Osdahl, which caused it to float out into the middle of the slough and get stuck. Neither Faulkner nor Osdahl said they'd heard about Fisher's terrible crash last winter. Anvil says she's not sure who's responsible for removing the barge, but she hopes it happens before someone else gets hurt.
It's going to be starting to get dark pretty soon, and nighttime you can't see that, you know, that there is a barge there, so I'm sure somebody's going to get hurt.
Shank's Ark is one of several rusting vessels that make the slough look like a graveyard for river-going barges. At last count, state officials say there were 22 abandoned vessels in the Bethel area, 13 of them in Steamboat Slough. DNR officials say the company operating the barge when it broke loose is responsible for removing it. Faulkner Walsh has submitted a plan to remove their sunken barge near Queethluck and two vessels in Steamboat Slough, but never removed any of them. They have not submitted a plan to remove Shank's Ark, which remains in the middle of the channel. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Coast Guard cutter Healy made a detour from its science mission in the Arctic last Saturday to rescue a sailboat trapped in ice near Barrow. The Altan Girl is a 36-foot steel boat trying to sail the Northwest Passage from Vancouver to eastern Canada. The vessel is Turkish-Canadian, according to the Nome Nugget. The newspaper says the boat's skipper, Erkin Gursoy, plans to sail across Canada all the way to Turkey. But the boat got stuck in sea ice Saturday, 40 miles northeast of Barrow. Weather conditions meant search and rescue couldn't fly in from the North Slope, so the Coast Guard diverted the Healy to help out. The Healy towed the Altan Girl through 12 miles of Arctic ice before they reached open water. The cutter's crew did a safety check, then they sent the sailboat back to Barrow to resupply and wait for better conditions. The Healy is now back on track with its Arctic research mission, funded by the National Science Foundation. Commercial salmon fishing is picking up in the waters of Lower Cook Inlet, with several areas opening this week. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
In the Southern District, the Port Graham Subdistrict opened July 14th to commercial set gill netting for the first time this season. Glenn Hollowell is the Fish and Game Finfish Area Management Biologist for the Lower Cook Inlet. He says returns haven't been especially high, so that fishery has been closed so far this season.
Because we've been tracking the sockeye return to English Bay Lakes, and it's been what I've called modest this year. We have just barely made our escapement goals with a subsistence fishery going on, but no commercial fishery. Had we had a commercial fishery, I think it would have depressed escapement to the lakes below the level that we want to see. And so we've kept the commercial fishery closed and the subsistence fishery open.
The sustainable escapement goal is 6,000 to 13,500 sockeye. As of July 11th, about 6,700 fish had returned. Beginning at 6 a.m. July 14th, it's open for regular 48-hour Monday and Thursday commercial fishing periods. The subsistence fishery will remain open. Set gill netting opened in portions of the Barabara Creek, Tutka Bay, Halibut Cove, and Seldovia Bay subdistricts in early June. Those areas will remain open for 2 48-hour fishing periods per week. Hollowell says it's still early in the season to tell, but this harvest doesn't seem to match up to last year's.
It seems like we've been running slightly ahead of the 10-year average, but last year was just an amazing year. We were way ahead of the 10-year average last year, and we seem to be trailing that a little bit this year.
The 10-year average for sockeyes is about 21,000 fish. The 2013 harvest was more than 29,000. So far this season, 22,000 reds have been caught by set gill netters in the Southern District. The purse seine fisheries in the Tutka Bay, Halibut Cove, and Humpy Creek subdistricts and the China Poot and Neptune Bay sections are also open.
And typically those are very, very slow fisheries until about now. And then they start to pick up as pink salmon come back through and as we start seeing coho and sockeye salmon. And the sockeye salmon harvest has picked up quite a bit in the purse seine fishery in the last week and a half, I would say.
As of July 3rd, only 373 sockeye had been caught. But by July 7th, that number had jumped to more than 1,300. In the Kamishak Bay District, the Chenik Subdistrict had its first purse seine opening July 12th through 14th.
And usually they go into Chenik Lake during high tide cycles. Well, apparently they got in during a moderate tide cycle. And so we've got about 6,000 fish in the lake, which is within the sustainable escapement goal that we like to see for there. And that's a 3,500 to a 14,000 escapement goal. So we're doing okay there.
Finally, in the outer district, there are openings in Port Dick and the Windy Bay, Rocky Bay, and Nuka Island subdistricts. Hollowell says as it is early in the season, it will still take some time to identify this year's trends in the commercial salmon harvest throughout Lower Cook Inlet. Reporting in Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.